This is the House Labor Committee meeting in Hearing Room B at the State Capitol. It's Wednesday, April 20, 7 p.m.
Labor Subcommittee on Workers' Compensation Benefits come to order. All members of the subcommittee are present. For the information of the audience, the proposed time schedule on this subcommittee, the next meeting will be Monday, April 25th. And if necessary, Wednesday, April 27th, and those are at 7 p.m. The subcommittee will report back to the full committee, and there is a work session scheduled before the full committee on the 29th of this month. Our purpose tonight is to take public testimony, and primarily the purpose of the night meeting is to take testimony from those who have not yet spoken on the bills before us, and especially those that have traveled a distance. First, we will not confine any witness to a particular bill. We encourage you, when you come up here, to speak on all of those bills on the agenda tonight at one point in time, and that's the way I propose to run the meeting tonight. The bills before us, as listed on the agenda, I'd like to have our counsel, Jennifer Friesen, summarize those before us and bring all of us up to date on those amendments that have been proposed since we last met. And if there are any further amendments or amendments tonight, we will take those and put them under our hat in consideration. The meeting tonight is solely going to be for public testimony. There will not be a work session tonight. Jennifer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The committee is considering six bills which relate generally to the topic of benefits to injured workers. In some cases, amendments have been proposed, and I'll describe those briefly. However, no amendments have yet been adopted. First bill on our agenda is House Bill 2376. House Bill 2376 raises the maximum or ceiling on the benefits that a permanently or temporarily totally disabled worker takes home per month, from the maximum now being 100% of the state average weekly wage, or $403, to 200% of the state average weekly wage. The important thing to note about the bill is that it raises benefits for a relatively small minority of workers. Only those in the higher echelons of wages will benefit, we're told, by an increase in the ceiling. Amendments to that bill that have been proposed, Mr. Kalinowski of Associated General Contractors has proposed an amendment which recomputes the wage on which the benefits are based by going back to four out of the last five quarters and taking an average of that rather than the wage at the time of injury, which is presently the practice. Second amendment proposed by the AFL-CIO on March 9th adds new language to House Bill 2376, which is unrelated to the major topic in the bill. The new language adds a notification section to notify injured workers that they have certain rights under the unemployment law for an extended base year when they recover. If they recover and can't find work, they many times want to open an unemployment claim and may not know that they have a right to an extended base year in that circumstance. That's the purpose of that amendment. The second bill on our agenda is House Bill 2378 relating to attorney fees for injured claimants who have contested denied claims. The bill does not add attorney's fees in, or doesn't pay attorney fees in situations where they're not already paid. However, it does say that when they are paid, they are to be over and above the amount of the worker's award and not come out of that award, which is sometimes the practice presently. There are no amendments offered to House Bill 2378 at this time. House Bill 2379 relates to survivor's benefits, the spouse and children of a worker who is killed in on the job or whose on the job injury results in death are entitled to a pension. This bill raises the maximum that the widow or widower can receive. It also, as presently written, raises the amount allowed for funeral, burial, transportation of the body expenses. There are two amendments proposed to House Bill 2379. One by the AFL-CIO, the proponent of the bill, on February 21st, changes the, rewords certain language in the bill, doesn't change the intent of the bill in a significant way. Another was proposed by Representative Larry Hill on April the 8th. Representative Hill's amendment addresses a different category of survivors, that is the spouse and the spouse in particular, the spouse of a worker who is on permanent total disability when that worker dies. It could be from a car crash or an unrelated disease or whenever the permanently totally disabled worker dies, the spouse is entitled to certain benefits that the worker was receiving at the time of death. However, for historical reasons which are lost in the mists of antiquity, the legislature forbade spouses to collect unless they were married to that injured worker at the time of injury or within 2 years thereafter. And Representative Hill's amendment removes that restriction so that if, to take an example, a woman marries an injured worker 10 years after he is disabled and then he dies, she will be entitled to those benefits the same as if she had been married to him at the time of injury. And that's all the amendments to House Bill 2379 that have been proposed. House Bill 2467 is related to the hearings process for contested workers' comp claims, and it's restricted to a very narrow situation. It addresses the case where a worker has had an injury and has had the claim denied, but that worker is mentally not in a condition to appreciate the significance of the denial or to know that they have to file a request for a hearing within a certain amount of time. The bill seeks to grant a grace period to individuals in that situation who are mentally so ill or unstable that they don't realize their time is running out. It's based on a case in which a woman was committed to damage, I believe, and when her denial came and didn't file a timely request for a hearing and therefore could not get paid. There is an amendment, two amendments proposed to House Bill 2467. One from the SAFE Corporation on March 7th, which would do two things. One, establish a time limit for this grace period, a maximum, I believe, 5 years or 1 year after recovery from the mental condition. The second thing the SAFE Amendment would accomplish would be to restrict this grace period to persons who are actually committed to a mental hospital. A second amendment proposed by Representative Gold on April 8th includes the time limit for the grace period that the SAFE amendment proposed, but expands the category of people who'd be eligible for the grace period by defining it as persons who are either actually committed or voluntarily committed, or suffering from the type of mental disease that would make that person eligible for commitment. House Bill 2473 relates to seeks to establish an exception to the workers' comp laws in a situation where an employer has removed a safety device from a machine or apparatus and worker as a result is injured. What this bill would accomplish would be, in that situation, take away from the employer the general immunity that the employer enjoys from suit for damages by an injured worker, and concurrently give the injured worker in that situation a right to sue the employer for damages for his or her injury due to the employer's act of removing the safety device. There have been no amendments proposed to House Bill 2473. House Bill 2700 relates to firefighters and is also related to the litigation or hearings process to establish workers' claims. This bill is related to a very narrow class of claims, and that is heart and lung type disabilities which are suffered by firefighters. It seeks to establish that when a firefighter has been on the job for 5 years and comes down with a heart or lung related disability, that their standard of proof that should result in an award of disability is easier than in the normal case. The rationale behind the bill, as explained by the proponents, is that there's a very high statistical correlation between heart and lung disease and the work of firefighting. Specifically, the bill would establish that if a firefighter who is 5 years on the job has that disability, the language of the bill is it shall be conclusively presumed that the disability is job-related and therefore compensable. There is to be an amendment offered this evening, I understand, to that bill, which changes the conclusive presumption and removes the word conclusively, returns it to the original language of the statute, which is simply a presumption. But the amendment also would add that the employer or insurer wishing to defeat such a claim would have to offer, quote, clear and convincing, unquote, evidence that the injury or disability was in fact related to something other than the job.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last bit you said. I apologize.
The second part of the amendment, which is to be offered, it relates to the last line in the bill, and we'll distribute those. But it would require that evidence offered in rebuttal by the employer or the insurer to defeat that type of a claim would have to be, quote, clear and convincing, unquote, evidence rather than merely evidence. And that has a legal significance, which I'm sure the proponents will explain.
Thanks, Jennifer. I think you said the average weekly wage in Oregon is $403, and I believe the correct, it's the other way around. It's $304.
I knew it had a
and 60
ring
cents.
Right.
Thank you. The first witness we have signed up tonight is Tom Katsian. And I see that you signed up on more than one, Tom, so if you'd identify yourself for the record.
All right. Tom Katsian. My name is Tom Katsian. I'm employed with the Globe Battery Division of Johnson Controls in Canby, Oregon. Globe Battery Division manufactures automotive replacement batteries, and our plant presently manufactures 5,000 batteries a day, employs in excess of 200 people. We began our operation in 1948 in Oregon, moving from Washington. We have experienced growth from 200 batteries a day up to the present level of 5,000 a day. We started out with 10 employees. Johnson Controls has 16 battery plants throughout the nation, and we have experienced an excellent growth rate in all of our plants. Our last expansion was in 1978, when we went from 3,800 batteries a day to the present level of 5,000 a day. This expansion increased our employment by some 60 jobs. Our plant currently leads the battery division in both health standards and safety standards compliance within our corporation, having to do with blood lead levels and lead and air levels. And we have an excellent rapport with the Workman's Compensation Board and the safety and health compliance people. However, we're amongst the worst in our battery division when it comes time for our safety record and our workman's compensation lost time injuries. We've evaluated ourselves in many different ways, and the bottom line continually comes out that Oregon has got less standards that are worked to the advantage of the employer, and we have found that in a lot of cases, it becomes an incentive for an employee to claim on-the-job injury rather than off-the-job injury and receive, in our particular case with our health insurance plan, in excess of $100 a week less. The first bill that I'd like to address is 2376, and that is having to do with the PPD and the TPD. At the present level, that's $304 a week. This is currently next to the highest of the 16 plants that we have throughout the nation. There's only one other state that has a higher rate than the state of Oregon. In addition, just within our western states, seven western states, Oregon currently rates the highest. We believe any additional increase would not be to the advantage of economic development or business expansion within the state of Oregon. 2378, requiring attorney's fees and workers' compensation. We believe that the awards that are presently given out take into account the attorney's fees that are awarded, and to award attorney's fees over and above that disability rating would again only add to the cost of the workman's compensation in the state of Oregon. 2379, increase into the workers' compensation, burial, and surviving spouse benefits. Again, Oregon rates the highest as it presently is. If we compare our seven other western states, we're the highest. Four of those other states have $1,500 or less, and our present rate is sitting at $3,000. Our business believes that these are excessive, they're very costly, and if, as our corporation asks us to project or give our five-year projections within the state of Oregon, the workman's compensation rates that we're having to presently pay are going to weigh seriously as to whether or not our plant continues to expand within the state of Oregon to the present to the projected level of some 8,000 batteries a day, or whether we consider relocating our expansion programs to states such as Idaho, Nevada, Utah, where it's not a disincentive for an employer to insure workers for workman's compensation. Thank you. Yes?
Quick question. Are you insured with a carrier, or self-insured? Or
We're insured through Employers of Wausau.
Wausau, yes. Okay.
Mr. Kotzian,
yes.
Where are your operating, your corporate structure operates in 16
states? Our corporate office is
states, is that correct? Did you say?
Our battery division has 16 different locations throughout the nation.
Can you tell us what other states that you operate in?
I didn't bring the list with me. I'll try and run down them. You got Vermont, you got Middletown, Delaware, you got Owosso, Michigan, Geneva, Illinois, Tampa, Florida, Garland, Texas, Fullerton, California, St. Joe, Missouri, Texarkana, Arkansas, Louisville, Kentucky, Florence, Kentucky, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Toledo, Ohio, I don't know, how many is that?
12.
Winston-Salem.
North Carolina.
Yes. Atlanta, Georgia. I'm lacking two. Portland, Oregon. Canby, Oregon. That's 15.
Close.
Your employees employed at an hourly rate?
Yes.
Normally?
Yes. Well, our wage scale is
set up. Can you tell us what your wage scale goes from and to?
Okay. Our average employees are around $11 to $11.50 an hour. We pay a base salary plus incentive, so that the harder the employee works, the more money he makes. Our base salaries run in the $8-$9 neighborhood, and by the time they compute in their incentive earnings, they're in the $11 to $15 neighborhood.
Other questions? Representative Shipwreck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, I was a little bit confused when you were mentioning the average weekly wage and in regards to House Bill 2376. You mentioned that it was the highest or amongst the highest in the West and nationally. Did you mean the average weekly wage or the benefits?
No, the maximum allowable benefit.
Okay.
Okay.
I wanted to clarify
yes.
that. I wanted to make one more comment that...
Sure.
I spent a couple, 3 days in your plant doing a little wiring, and
well, you did.
I wanted to compliment you. It's a very nice place to work.
Thank you. We're very proud of it.
And it's also a very safe place to work, mm-hmm. as far as I was concerned. I was really impressed.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Dana Reifschneider.
My name is Dana Reifschneider. I'm representing myself, and this has to do with House Bill 2378. In particular, on August 7th, 1981, I injured myself by cutting my finger at work. I was taken up to the university hospital where they had me wash out my own finger. I fell from vertigo, got woozy, and fractured my skull and lost the hearing in my right ear. Due to a state statute, I was not able to sue the hospital. Therefore, there's another House Bill 2677 that is also, hopefully will cover that one.
Can you get that, while you're going on that, I want to get that straight. You were injured under workers' comp. You cut your finger, and you
Correct.
Went to the University of Oregon Medical School for treatment.
Correct.
And suffered another injury there when you passed out.
Yes.
And you were told that isn't that the hospital is not responsible for anything that happens there under our law.
Correct.
Okay.
And with the numerous workman's compensation laws, I had really no other alternative other than to try and or go see counsel to find out what I could do. And then when I did get my award for loss of time and for my hearing, fractured skull, some loss of olfactory, which was smell. Part of this award goes to the attorney, which is normally about 25%. I probably would not have even gotten that if I had not gone to an attorney. So I don't see, you know, an injured worker, other than a minor injury like a cut finger, I would not have to see an attorney. But anything over that, an injured worker has no alternative but to see an attorney.
Could you explain, at least in the system, you were compensated under the workers' compensation system for the skull injury, though. Is that what you... Am I correct?
I was compensated for the loss of hearing, olfactory, which was the smell, and some on the head.
And
which was unscheduled.
Your workers' compensation claim, I take it, was shut by the evaluation division. Can you tell us what award you received at that point in time?
It was okay. 7,360.
And at that point in time, was it that you went to a lawyer?
No, it was before this time. Okay. As soon as I got out of the hospital and was able to go see one.
Was that the reason for the reason you went to an attorney was you felt you had some claim against the hospital, I would assume, as a result of
yes,
what happened there?
I thought I would have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, that claim would not have probably been compensable, would it? For his claim as to verification of his rights to sue the hospital. Would that have been compensable?
It's my understanding of the law that Oregon state law now prohibits anyone from suing a public body if any workers' compensation claim covers the injury, and I think that's probably your situation.
Correct.
That's right.
But I also have had other accidents at work, and safe or workman's compensation. I've always felt that they are there to help the injured worker, and I've always gotten the feeling when I've talked to them that they're not there for that reason. They're there to get you to say that you were feeling just fine when you actually are not. And that's where you end up in a hassle where, especially if you have to go to a hearing or anything, you have to have a lawyer in order to know what's going on.
Representative Johnson, did you have a question?
Are you presently reemployed then?
Yes, I am.
Did you go back to the same firm?
I did at the time, yes. I'm not employed there now.
That's all I have.
Thanks. Representative Shiprock.
Why did you hire an attorney?
Why?
Mm-hmm.
Just for the simple fact that I don't know the laws. I don't know what's going on. And
did someone advise you to hire an attorney?
No, not really. I advise myself.
Do you feel that attorney helped you?
The attorney could not help me, other than to see that everything went as smoothly as possible with safe or workman's compensation as far as hearings and for stipulations.
Looking back on it, do you think you could have went through it without an attorney?
No. I would not have known what to do or who to go to.
Didn't the comp people or the employer help you out on it?
My employer, no, other than filling out the original accident form. Workman's Compensation sends you a booklet and tells you what your rights are, and and that you have the right to see an attorney. Hmm. But if you don't I've seen books of workman's compensation laws, and there is no way they could send you a book through the mail to know what's going on.
Yeah. So as soon as you got out of the hospital, you hired counsel then?
Correct.
And Was this, this is a small question, was that before or after they'd, the comp department had sent you this book? When did you get the book?
Before. I had a previous injury, mm-hmm. and I had received a booklet before, mm-hmm. so I know what I would receive through the mail,
mm-hmm.
from the injury.
You hired counsel before you got this book for this claim?
Correct.
One more question.
Sure. You'd had a previous claim, so I'm assuming you had you knew what to expect to some extent.
Correct.
And did you hire counsel on your previous claim before this one?
No.
The question I have to ask you: you come out of the hospital and you hired an attorney. And you didn't before. Is there some reason?
I knew that I had a fractured skull and I was deaf in one ear.
I see. You little. Obviously underwriting the insurance on boilers, and they actually have field inspectors. Is there any relation? Does this happen in workers' comp? Are there insurance companies that will go into their insured's workplaces?
Mr. Chairman, representing Shipwreck, yes. And in fact, that's a growing part of workers' compensation coverage, mm-hmm. is safety inspection and risk management.
Now, they have a vested interest in
it. Yes, they do. And in fact, that's, I think, one of those services that many of our companies offer employers that attracts them to their coverages. In fact, those very kinds of services, those safety inspections and monitoring, and they'll actually go out and do a survey and a list of improvements to be made for safety, and that's an ongoing process.
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
Mr. Powell, we've had some testimony before on this bill that the effect of such bill, such law, may well be a safety inspector self-enforcing mechanism without having the safety inspector come around. That is, the potential of such a claim would be self-enforcing and conducive to a safer workplace, at least in this particular instance. Do you have any comment on that?
I do, Mr. Chairman. I believe in a limited number of cases it would provide exactly that kind of an incentive. However, it's been my experience in the area of workers' compensation that most employers, particularly at the supervising level, do not know the workers' comp law. They do not know that that liability actually exists. And when we start relying upon their understanding of the workers' compensation law to provide safety, I think it's a step backwards. However, if there is a safety program on board, those people are generally schooled or trained in that safety program. I remember working on the Green Chain, I was told that if my hard hat was not on, if I did not have my steel-toed shoes on, at any one time I was automatically fired, no grievance through the union. Just automatically fired. Reason, a safety inspector could shut the entire mill down if they stepped foot on that property and caught one of us without our earplugs on, our hard hat, and our steel shoes. We obeyed that, and our supervisors made sure we obeyed that. I don't think my supervisor knew anything about workers' comp liability or workers' compensation law.
Thank you. Mr. Ken Roberts.
Thank you, Chairman Hanlon. I apologize for not having signed up earlier, but I came late, and I have with me Dennis Fabrosky, an attorney from Portland. I'm Ken Roberts, an attorney from Portland, and Dick Hart sits between us, who is the president of the Oregon Self-Insureds. And there were several bills that I would like to speak to. I think that Representative Hanlon knows my name and my practice, but the other gentleman on the committee may not. I'm primarily a defense attorney representing self-insured employers in the state of Oregon as well as insurance companies in the state of Oregon. Historically, I've done and represented claimants in the past on a periodic basis, but not on any regular basis. I wouldn't say that my practice would have involved any more than 3 to 5% of my time representing claimants, but I have represented them in the past and represent some claimants at the present time. Several bills have myself personally concerned, which is the reason I'm here and interested in presenting some testimony. House Bill 2700, which has just been discussed by Mr. Whalen, I think has me concerned when it raises a conclusive presumption as it regards firemen.
Mr. Roberts, there was an amendment presented on that which describes it as the standard as a clear and convincing standard on the employer. I mean, that's the way it has been proposed to us.
Okay, is it now amended to that?
It is not amended, but the sole proponent of the bill has suggested that in lieu of conclusive.
Okay. I would still be concerned about that standard as I think that standard in the law is somewhat confused, and I think as you pointed out in previous discussion with Mr. Whalen, you raised the discrepancies that appear in our own understandings as lawyers as to what that means and our interpretation of what the court believes it means. And I found that in my experience a difficulty when dealing with the referees as to the weight that they will in fact attach to what has been described either as a presumption, conclusive presumption, or the now amended statute. And what I find is a considerable amount of confusion with difficulty on the employer's part, for example, knowing what burden of proof they're exactly expected to overcome. Anticipating that the bill will be amended to the different standard, I won't speak to the conclusive other than to say that would be really a detrimental situation. But in overall picture, I've recently been involved in a number of heart attack cases, and I've tried many of them in my past experience. And in dealing with the physicians, the experts in the area, cardiologists in particular, you find a tremendous amount of confusion and more of a philosophical point of view as it regards atherosclerotic disease, which is more often than not the considered culprit in heart attack cases, and its relationship to either work or stress or anything else. And it, we find in our experience that a lot of it, again, depends on their philosophy towards whether or not stress is a major factor. But recently there was a study, and maybe you're already familiar with it, of the Los Angeles Fire Department, in which a 10-year study was done, in which approximately in excess of 200 firemen were observed as compared to a general population of over 1,600 non-fireman people. And the conclusion of at least that particular study was that there was no evidence to establish that firemen had any greater incidence of atherosclerotic disease than did anyone else, than did the 1,600. And when you're talking about either physical or emotional stress, it's applicable to the atherosclerotic disease process. And if there's no greater incidence or no evidence to support the conclusion that there's a greater incidence of atherosclerotic disease in firemen as compared to anyone else, it seems that that this bill is creating a standard different for those people in the general working population without any real support for that kind of conclusion, at least from the medical community, if one accepts this particular study. It's recognized that not all physicians will agree. It's also recognized that medicine is not a absolute science, but this is the only study I'm familiar with right now which has done a comparison with non-firemen and actual firemen. I don't have a copy of that with me, but if you do not have a copy or are interested in a copy, I could provide a copy. A copy was given to me by Dr. Kloster, who I believe is the head of cardiology at the University of Oregon Medical School. And he's testified on both sides, if we call it the fence. He's testified on behalf of claimants in heart attack cases as well as employers.
I'd like to be able to borrow that if we could.
We have another study that sounds awfully familiar that we've already had presented to the committee on that.
It's from L.A. also.
Pardon?
The study was also from L.A.
It may be the same one.
Be the same.
Probably the major difference, sir, was
had
that
different conclusions, though.
Yeah, that's what I
was. One was paid for by the paid for by the
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Shipwright.
I just wanted to point out that I don't think that we are in no position, nor are we here tonight to argue whether firemen have higher heart diseases than the general population. It's been the law for many years that current law, in fact, that they do. So we're in no position to argue those points. I think that we're here simply to render a judgment as to what grounds we're going to use to prove that the heart disease or respiratory disease was caused by their employment.
Well, and I'm Representative Chiprack, I'm not here to debate that point. There is a presumption in the law, and it's been there for some time,
years,
which gives them an advantage in these legal proceedings, and this body is not anticipating removing that presumption, and I'm not speaking to that question, but it would appear that if in fact it would appear that that standard would be sufficient, at least at this point in time, to cover those individuals without any adjustment in that particular standard. But that's the only issue I'm speaking to. And I'll tell you, the reason I became familiar with that study is only because Dr. Kloster was testifying in another case on behalf of a claimant, and he brought the study up, and I became aware of it through the examination.
We've had testimony here earlier tonight about the U of O med school. In a different manner, though.
I heard that. On that particular bill, I don't have anything else to add unless anyone else here would have anything to add on that.
Was that the attorney fee bill? 2378 is the attorney fee bill.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
I might more fully identify myself. I practice exclusively workers' compensation defense and presently serve as the president of the Association of Workers' Compensation Defense Attorneys. This association has appeared before committees of this legislature before on behalf of employers.
Excuse
and carriers.
Me. I'm sorry. Can I have name identification, please?
I'll give you a card.
No, I need it for the record.
On tape.
Babrowski. V as in Victor, A, V as in Victor.
You didn't state your name.
I'm sorry. Dennis Babrowski. At any rate, with respect to 2378, the feedback that our association receives is that this additional layer to the system, and I believe that there was previous testimony tonight that might add another $5 to $10 million in benefits on the system, is so costly that, again, it adds to the negative business climate in the state of Oregon. Mr. Kapsian appeared before you earlier this evening and indicated that his company, Johnson Controls, has operations in 16 different states, including Florida. In a conversation with Mr. Kapsian prior to coming forward here, he indicated to me that their Florida experience of Johnson Controls has been that that state has cost them more in litigation than any other state, and principally, as he related to me, as a result of adding the layer of workers of attorney's fees to workers' compensation awards. It has been stated by various people that brought about the Florida experience, the amendments to the Florida Act to get into the wage loss concept, because their attorney's fees were so much a part of that system. I don't have the figures what attorney's fees are with respect to our system here, and I think the department has provided that information in various testimonies. But our clients, the association's clients, are very concerned about adding another layer of benefits to the system that's already in existence. And one of the concerns specifically is what's been variously referred to as a blackmail situation that involves small claims. the gentleman that you heard earlier that had the grievous experience at the University of Oregon Medical School started out with a finger claim and, of course, ended up with something much more tragic and heinous. If he had only had a finger claim and had received a determination order awarding him 50% of the finger and had sought an attorney to appeal that, it may very well be that under this present proposal, 2378, that he'd not only receive 100% of the finger, or something less thereof, but he'd receive something in the nature of $1,000 in attorney's fees, which may be worth more than four or five fingers. Our association believes, therefore, that this bill would actually foment litigation and add additional costs to the system. With respect to 2473, the safety device bill, our association has been approached by many of its clients with respect to the purpose of this bill as eroding exclusive liability. The reason for the Workers' Compensation Act was to get away from fault. That is employee fault as well as employer fault. The association and its clients feel that passing a bill such as this is one chink in that armor that will erode exclusive liability and bring us to a system where the employer suffers the worst of both worlds. There was a question asked whether, in fact, allowing an employee to sue the employer directly would reduce workers' compensation insurance rates. I propose to you that if that actually occurred, then the corresponding increase in rates for liability would more than make up for any savings to the employer. Finally, I'd like to address 2467, which is the mental incapacity bill. It appears that this bill was introduced to correct one particular horror story about a woman who was incarcerated or committed to a mental institution, was unable to appeal her denial within a 60-day provision. It's our position that a bill that is so limited in its application and yet so broad and widespread in its verbiage is not a proper bill to address before this legislature. We would support, however, if any such bill is passed, the SAFE Amendment 2, which actually takes care of the horror story that was the purpose of this bill. I believe that SAFE Amendment 2 was that this bill would only apply if there's actual commitment to an institution. And Mr. Hart from the Oregon Self-Insurers Association indicated that he would like to address the safety device issue.
Could ask a question? We'll take some questions from Mr. Vaprovsky.
Yes, thank you.
And feel free to Mr. Roberts, too, if we missed anything. Representative Johnson.
I don't have the 2467 file, but the proposed amendments, I'd just like to get your interpretation of what those amendments would mean. I was thinking the ones that Shirley had.
Those are
hers?
Yeah. While you're doing that, Representative Johnson, if I might just ask a question myself. Mr. Vavrovsky, you said the safety would be an inroad into the exclusivity of the chapter protecting workers or employers from suit if workers' comp is provided. Isn't it true there are already exceptions?
I'm sorry, I didn't agree.
Such as the red tag exception and the intentional injury exception.
Excuse me, I missed your question.
I created a problem, I'm sorry.
You were talking about the exclusivity of liability and the guard proposed bill, removal of the guard bill, and saying that would put a chink into the armor of the exclusivity under the statute. It's true there are some other exceptions provided, and two examples I can think of are the red tag exception and the intentional wrong by the employer exception. Under those circumstances, an employee has the right to sue the employer, if I'm correct.
Well, I'm not saying that there aren't any chinks in the armor. What we're concerned about is that this goes too far, that this type of situation reveals itself as going an additional step, and then there'll be another additional step, and soon you'll have an employee who may be negligent in his own right receiving benefits where the employer is more negligent than the employee. I don't mean benefits. I mean able to sue the employer. And then there's absolutely no reason for a workers' compensation system. And frankly, many employers have come to us and said, we'd rather go back to the old Employees Liability Act, because then we can prove or we can defend on the basis that the employee is also negligent. I'm not proposing that as an amendment.
Well, since that hasn't been changed in this state since 1913, I think maybe we'll look at that next session.
I think it was introduced last session.
Was it?
I think it probably was.
He's got everything.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I did want to bring that to your attention and see if you had any of the same concerns that I have. I don't know what it means exactly, and maybe without those two statutes you wouldn't be clear on it, but it seemed like it occurs to me we might be opening that door wider than we really intend to in dealing with specifically the Nelson case or a similar case. I just wanted to get some view if you were prepared at all to comment.
Well, yeah. I do believe that it opens the door too widely.
That was a concern, and the reason I had that the qualified bit or would permit the person to be voluntarily and voluntarily committed, even using the statutes that I don't know if they have the conditions under which that would occur, but you would probably end up with litigation in every case when you use that system to decide whether I can't think of a way you could deal with it on a rule basis to deal with that issue if there was a problem of that kind.
Well, Representative Johnson, I think that's the point. I think this bill needs to be narrowly confined. If it is not narrowly confined to a Nelson-type situation, then it invites litigation and it invites doctor shopping for psychologists and psychiatrists that will come in and testify that the claimant, I didn't see the claimant till 90 days later, but I think 59 days from the denial, he or she was mentally incapable of forming a decision to appeal this denial. I think that opens the door too widely. That's why I say that we would support, if the bill needs to be passed because another Nelson case may be out there, then let's confine it to another Nelson case.
I think we had the sense I had of the committee was that we were trying to deal with a narrow issue and not much broader than that particular case, but it worried me that we were getting farther afield by some bit than our initial concerns. The sponsor of the bill really, I don't believe, had any desire to go much beyond that.
I would hope so, but the problem is that the bill, if passed in its present form, and even with respect to some of the proposed amendments, would merely invite litigation over the interpretation of mental incapacity.
That's what I was trying to get your impression.
I think there'd be a lot of litigation over that.
Mr. Vavrosky, to follow up on that.
Mr. Chairman.
Can you suggest what you think would be wording not to invite litigation?
In House Bill 2467?
Well, I think that's what Representative Johnson was getting at. And maybe I'm asking that for you to go home and think on it and get it back to us.
Well, it may be. But, Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, that most bills that are passed by the legislature invite litigation. And I don't think there's any way around it unless there's enough public testimony or statements confining the bill to certain situations. But this is the kind of bill that needs to be narrowly constructed and therefore narrowly construed, hopefully, But if it is a Nelson-type bill, let's say that it is, and restrict it to those claimants who are institutionalized during the time period when an appeal should be filed.
Then again, you come along with somebody like me that says there are a lot of people out there that should have been that aren't. And, you know, well, we do a lot of balancing in this process, as you well know. Anything further, gentlemen?
I have a question.
Representative Shipwright.
I want to talk about these attorney's fees. I wanted to know, are you, typically, do you work exclusively for a certain, this group, the self-insureds people?
Well, both self-insureds and carriers.
Okay.
Well, and it's on an hourly basis, Representative Shipwright.
I'll get right to my question. When you are defending either a carrier or self-insured employer on an appeal, is there any difference between what you receive if you successfully or unsuccessfully win that, defend the case. I'm not a member of the bar, so you have to bear with me on these. I mean, you send them a bill for services rendered.
For services rendered, for time involved. Win or lose.
Thank you. That's all I wanted to know.
Representative Shipwreck, I think you had some prior testimony from another member of our organization, Roger Lutke, with respect to that situation. And if that's still fresh in your mind, I don't think there's any reason for me to expand upon that. Now, we don't work on a contingent fee.
You hear these bills, it's incumbent upon us to think of all the possibilities.
Yes.
And what I sometimes like to turn things around, and we have a situation where an employee has to pay his attorney out of his pocket to get what was rightfully his in the first place. And turning that situation around, that was a reason for my question.
Well, Representative Shipwreck, I suppose I'm in a little conflict situation. If this bill foments more litigation, I make more money. Because there's more litigation.
Yeah. I what do you think of this opinion, though, that if a injured worker appeals the decision of the board or his award, and the carrier knows that if that carrier loses that appeal, he has to pay attorney's fees on top of the award, I'm of the opinion possibly that he would possibly settle out of court. Isn't that also something to look at?
Representative Shipwreck, that's a real possibility. Unfortunately, it's a matter of blackmail. If you're looking at smaller cases and saying that perhaps you can reduce litigation by showing the carrier or the employer that it's not economically feasible to defend a case, even though they know that all the evidence points to no increase or a slight increase, then what you're going to have is you're either going to have a lot of litigation or less litigation. You're going to perhaps give a windfall to claimants who will settle a case rather than take it to hearing. One thing this bill doesn't do is indicate how the attorney is paid if the case is settled.
Oh. What do you mean by that?
Well, let's assume that Mr. Snyder, whoever he was, went to hearing on his finger case, and the carrier said, well, I'm not going to go to hearing on that because the finger's only worth another $200.
Mm-hmm.
The attorneys filed a request for hearing and said, well, you better give me not only $200, but let's throw in some psychological disability or something else. I want $700 for that finger. I know it's only worth another $200, but I want $700 for it, and I'll take a $300 fee out of that, or you can pay the claimant $400, and I'll take $300.
Mm-hmm.
That could very conceivably happen. And now that's a matter of settlement. How is he going to get his fee other than agreeing with the carrier that a portion of it will be paid to the attorney? And if they don't agree on the attorney fee, they're going to have to submit it to the referee and have the referee set an attorney fee over and above the award. And the award is only 100% is only another $200.
Well, the additional attorney's fees, can correct me if I'm wrong, are only on appeal that you actually go. You don't, the referee wouldn't set that unless it actually did go to appeal,
well,
as I understand.
Let me, Representative, any request for hearing is an appeal. The filing of a request for hearing is an appeal.
My point is, if you settled out of court, the chances are that a lot of these would be settled out of court. And you're right, it could go either way. I don't know. In certain instances, maybe it would. In others, maybe they'd fight it in court.
Well, I guess one of my problems is, philosophically, Mr. Representative, is we have a system that during appeal, when a request for hearing is filed, the case goes to hearing. Testimony is presented, and the first layer of appeal is that decided by a referee.
Mm-hmm.
If a referee decides a case in favor of the claimant, our statutes require that the employer pay those benefits pending appeal regardless of what happens to it up above.
Mm-hmm.
So the employer may win, and there are cases that I'm sure that this committee has heard,
mm-hmm,
where the employer has paid out. One case in particular, I think it was the RIF case, RYF, some years ago, where the employer paid out $76,000 until the case was finally reversed by the Court of Appeals. But regardless of that, you're not, I guess what I'm addressing myself to is the contingency of the situation. A claimant may gamble and go to hearing, but the claimant still has no gamble here. Under our system, the claimant doesn't have to pay any fees out of his pocket. He pays contingent upon an increase